Churchill was in his early 30s. He tried with all his powers to awaken the English-speaking world to the impending danger of a resurgent Germany. At the time, Germany was being influenced by one Corporal Hitler. But Churchill's warnings were to no avail. So it was kind of ironic, really, that soon after conflict broke out, that Britain turned to Churchill in their fight against Nazism. And this sense of irony never left him. On one occasion, President Roosevelt asked him a question. He said to Churchill, what did he feel the Second World War should have been called? And Churchill answered without hesitation, the unnecessary war. The unnecessary war. And I guess Churchill knew the difficulty of getting people to listen, especially to listen to things they didn't really want to hear, and to be confronted with tough choices that affect people's lifestyle. Sadly, for many people, only calamity makes them take notice of things that they should be noticing all the time. And here in Luke chapter 12, Jesus brings before the crowds and the disciples tough choices, things that perhaps they don't want to hear. But if they don't take heed of them, it'll be too late and devastation may follow. What is the tough teaching that Jesus brings? Well, there's a number of things, actually, if you scan the chapter. In verses 1 to 12, he's been talking about beware of hypocrisy, double standards. He wants his followers to be genuine. Beware of hypocrisy. Then in 13 to 21, beware of covetousness, longing after money and possessions. In other words, be content with what you have. And then in verses 22 to 34, he talks about beware of worrying. Get your focus on God. Be focused. Trust in God. Don't worry. That's not going to make any difference whatsoever. And then he gives these two parables. And it's another warning. Beware of carelessness. Beware of negligence. And in these verses, Jesus shifts the emphasis. He's been talking about being worried in the present. But now he's talking about being concerned about the future. And I want to note the highlighting of those two little words, be ready, be ready. And these two parables actually complement and complete all his previous teaching about hypocrisy, covetousness, worrying. When you are living in the future tense, it is much harder for those worldly things, hypocrisy, covetousness, worrying, to ensnare you when you're focused on the future. C.S. Lewis put it this way: aim at heaven and you get earth thrown in as well. Aim at earth and you get neither. In other words, be focused on that which is truly important. And I want to divide this morning into four headings. Number one, be alert. As the old joke says, Britain needs alerts. Okay, so be alert. There was a king of England called Ethelred. He was king of England 978 to 1013, and then he had a second reign 1014 to 1016. But he had a very unusual nickname, Ethelred the Unready. Ethelred the Unready. Actually, the nickname's a little bit unfair, because he became king when he was 10 years old. So he was very dependent on his advisors. And if his advisors, who made all the decisions really, gave him bad advice, then what was a 10-year-old boy going to do? He was bound to be unready. And when the enemies attacked, because he was badly advised, he was badly prepared, it meant that he had to then try and bribe his way out of the situation. But history has nicknamed him Ethelred the Unready. Jesus tells his followers here in verse 35, don't be an Ethelred. Be prepared. The NIV puts it, be dressed, ready for service. I like the King James Version. Let your loins be girded about. Just sounds painful, doesn't it? Let your loins be girded about. In Jesus' day, servants had long flowing robes. And when work needed to be done, you tied them up in your belt, which gave you free access of movement. You weren't going to trip over your robes. They weren't going to get in the way. And so you tied them up, you girded them, you put a belt around them to keep them tucked in. And Jesus says to his disciples, hey, be ready for action. Whether you wear flowing robes or not, be in that state of mind. There is work to be done. Suppose you get dressed when you're going out, don't you? Or if you're on duty. At home, you may have a lazy day. I was very embarrassed at Christmas. I didn't get up. Well, I got up late, and then I went to my office, and I was unshaven. I was in pyjamas, dressing gown. It was about 1 o'clock, and the front doorbell went. I assumed it was the postman. And so I went to the door, opened it up, and there was somebody who had never seen me in that state before. And their mouth just dropped, as if to say, you haven't surely just got out of bed. And it's 1 o'clock, and you're not even dressed yet, never mind washed or shaved. And I didn't know what to say. I was totally embarrassed. But it's good to have a lazy day at home, isn't it? It's good to have a day when you don't have to shave, you don't have to wash, you don't even have to comb your hair. But you can't have too many lazy days. And that's the point here. There are times when you have to get dressed, you have to get washed, you have to be ready. Either you're going out, you're on duty, you're at work, etc. And then you need to be prepared. Those two words, be prepared, of course, are well known by many people. Since 1907, they have been the motto of the Scout movement, and also the Girl Guides and the Girl Scouts. Two words, learned by millions of teenagers and young people around the world. Be prepared. And the Scout book will tell you this. The Scout motto, be prepared, means you are always in a state of readiness in mind and body to do your part. And it goes on to say, be prepared in mind by having disciplined yourself to be obedient to every order. And also by having thought out beforehand any accident or situation that may occur, so that you know the right thing to do at the right moment and are willing to do it. Be prepared in body by making yourself strong and active and able to do the right thing at the right moment and do it. That'd make a good commentary for this passage, wouldn't it? I don't know if Baden-Powell knew, had this in mind when he came up with that idea of be prepared. But Jesus is saying, always be ready in mind and be body for action. And actually, into this body of teaching, he brings a brand new concept that hasn't been there before. He's talking about going away and returning. If you use the parallel verses in Matthew's Gospel, it is specifically about the second coming. Here you can take it two ways. There are times when God may seem distant and then he suddenly works in our lives, so be ready for it. Or you can take the second view. He's talking primarily about the return of the Lord. And when you compare this with Matthew's parables, that's very, very true. And perhaps the primarily meaning. But in verse 40, he introduces this idea. The Son of Man will return at an hour when you do not expect him. When death or serious illness comes into a person's life, it causes them to reprioritize their lives, doesn't it? You suddenly realize what's important and what's not. What you need to do and what can just sit and chill for a while. In these two parables, Jesus says to his hearers, the very fact he's returning should have that same impact on a person's life. Reprioritize what's important and go for it. What can wait? What can be put to one side? What just clogs up life? Reprioritize. In other words, just as death and serious illness cause us to reassess our values, so should the fact that the Lord is coming. He wants to be at work in our lives, in our fellowship. So be ready. Be ready. Secondly, he says, be waiting and watching. Waiting and watching. Verse 36, servants whose master finds them watching when he comes. And Jesus takes on board a familiar everyday illustration, that of a wedding. We're all used to weddings, aren't we? Weddings are still big events. I guess they always have been throughout history. I was looking through the telechannels this week and came across a Hindu wedding, and they were just doing a documentary about an ordinary couple. They had 1,500 people at their wedding. And I thought, boy, I don't know who's picking up the tab, but I'm glad it's not me. Weddings are big occasions. According to the Wedding Guide UK, the average cost of getting married in Britain in 2011 was £15,500. That's actually dropped because of the recession. In 2008, the average cost was £20,000. But because of the recession, it's dropped by 25%. Weddings are expensive days, and they were in biblical times too. Big family occasions, community occasions in Bible times. And in the New Testament, Jewish weddings normally took place on a Wednesday. If the people were being married for the first time, they got married on Wednesday. If they were being, if someone was widowed or it was a second marriage, that took place on a Thursday. And the wedding often took place late in the evening, after a period of feasting and partying. That could just go on for hour after hour. Sometimes it could turn into days. And then with the wedding party in tow, they would march to the groom's house, and the wedding actually took place in the doorway of the groom's house. So the poor old servant stuck at home didn't know if the partying beforehand would last for hours or days or weeks. That's why they lost interest and went to sleep, or decided there's a lot of booze there and the master's not here, let's go help ourselves. They didn't know how or when the master would return. Jesus said to those people, oh, don't switch off. Be waiting and watching. Make sure the lamps are filled with oil, that they haven't run low and they're about to go out. Make sure the wicks are trimmed so that they'll burn brightly. Make sure everyone is ready for action as soon as the bride and the groom and the party suddenly appear. And so he takes a very familiar situation. Everyone knows about it. And then Jesus being Jesus, he turns it on its head. And he introduces something that was unheard of. There in verse 37. Did you notice what he said? That the master will serve the servants. I tell you the truth, when the master returns, he will dress himself to serve. When they're reclining at the table, he will come and wait on them. In Jewish weddings, the bride and groom were treated like king and queen. They didn't have to lift a finger. Everyone, it was their special day. But Jesus said, when the master returns, when the groom arrives, he's going to do the serving. In other words, he's going to bless the servants rather than the other way around. In fact, in verse 37 and verse 38, there's a little word repeated. Jesus used the word, it'll be good. Good when the master returns. And there's a double emphasis there. It'll be double good when the master returns, because he comes to bless. But that blessing, the master rewarding the servants, the master serving the servants, has a condition. Jesus said, if you want that to happen, you must be ready. You've got to be alert, attentive, not caught off guard. And that is the attitude you and I should have concerning the return of the Lord. We have to be alert if we want the blessing, if we want the thrill, if we want to know the master at work in our lives, in our situations. And then to emphasize the point, Jesus uses an illustration, verse 39. He said, like a thief in the night. A thief or a burglar, of course, strikes when no one is expecting them. Now, I don't want to worry you. But according to statistics, 1 in 10 houses are burgled every year. And you're sitting there now thinking, did we put that double lock on before we come out? Did we close that kitchen window? Ah! Of course, the success of a burglar depends on the element of surprise. If you knew you were going to be burgled, you'd sit in and wait for them. Or you'd have some heavy-handed yobbos there to sort them out. Or you'd at least have the police informed, ready for action. But the success of a burglar is you never know when they're coming. And Jesus makes the point. His return to planet Earth At times when he's at work in our lives is often when we least expect it. Robert Murray McShane was a great Presbyterian pastor, and he would often ask people, "Do you believe Jesus Christ is coming today?" And if the answer was no, he'd say, "Well, you better be ready, because it could be today. It's at an hour when you think not." And then Peter throws a question in. He says to Jesus, "Can you be specific?" He says in verse 41, "Are you telling this parable to us? We need to get ready. Or are you telling it to everyone?" Peter, of course, was often spokesman for the disciples. So it's no surprise he comes up with a question. Maybe he felt the demands of what Jesus was saying was too much for him and the 12 disciples. See, his question's a good one. Because all the way through the chapter, Jesus has been speaking to different people at different times. In verse 1, 4 and 22, he's speaking directly to the disciples. But also in verse 1 and 13, we're told, he's speaking to the crowds. And many believe verse 1 and then verse 15 to 21, he's specifically speaking to the Pharisees. So Peter says, "Hold on, is this for us, for them? Who are you talking to, Lord?" I suppose he feels the weight of Jesus' words. You see, if I said to you this week, congregation, can you make sure that the leaders of this church are behaving themselves and using their time and talents wisely this week? Keep an eye on them. All of a sudden, all the leaders of this church feel, uh-oh. I've got a lot of responsibility. Everyone's watching me. But if I actually said, actually, all of us this week need to be on our best behaviour. All of us this week need to watch our time. All of us this week need to watch how we use our money. All of us this week need to watch how we use our talents. Suddenly the responsibility is easier for the elders because they think, oh, it's not just me. This is for everyone. We're all in the same boat. The pressure's off. And that's why Peter says, "Lord, is this for us? Or is it for everyone?" And Jesus, being Jesus, doesn't answer his question with an answer. He gives him a parable. "You figure it out, Peter. You figure it out." For the teaching of Jesus is for everyone in one sense, as well as for those who claim to be his followers. And we have this second uncomfortable parable, verses 42 to 53. And it's about who then, said Jesus, is the faithful and the wise manager, whom the master puts in charge of his servants to give them food allowance at a proper time. We have an expression, don't we? When the cat's away, the mice will play. And human beings, as well as rodents, have that tendency to switch off when no one's watching. And although Jesus didn't use that expression, that's one of the themes in this parable. Waiting, watching, being ready, don't switch off. And Jesus added this second parable to encourage us to be awake and ready, but also obedient and busy. Obedient and busy. Verse 43 puts it this way. If the master returns and finds that the servant has done a good job, there will be a reward. And the parable shows the responsibility of obedience. God has given his servants gifts, talents, duties, responsibilities, and he expects us to get on and use them. He wants us to be active, not passive. Someone said this, "Our potential is God's gift to us. What we do with it is our gift to God." Our potential is God's gift to us. What we do with it is our gift to God. Antonio's voice was very high and very squeaky. And he had many tries out for different choirs. He was always rejected. "Sorry, Antonio," they said, "your voice is just too high. It's too squeaky. Not good enough." When he took up violin lessons, his neighbours persuaded his parents to make him stop. Yet Antonio wanted to make music. His friends gave him a hard time because his only talent was to whittle. He was forever having sticks and a penknife and just making them into sharp points. His knack for whittling grew into a skill for carving, and this hobby became his craft. He would work patiently and faithfully. By the time Antonio died, he left over 1,500 violins, each one bearing a label that read Antonio Stradivarius. They are, of course, the most sought-after violins in the world. And the last Stradivarius sold was sold for 3.5 million. Don't know if that's pounds or dollars, but it's a lot of money. There was a man who couldn't sing, he couldn't play, he couldn't preach, he couldn't teach, but he did have one skill, and he used it to the best of his ability. Our potential is God's gift to us. What we do with it is our gift to him. Verse 47 says, everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. Can I just say as we finish, in case you get sidetracked by verse 46, it's not a verse talking about losing your salvation. Because everyone is saved by grace through faith, not of works. And verse 46, if you read it casually, might sound like the master wants to break us off and send us away and cast us aside. But three things about verse 46, just as we close. First, remember this is a parable. It is a story, not a theological discourse. It's not a block of teaching where every line has a key point to make. It's a general story with one main point. And the principle in the parable is be working, be obedient. Second, the parable is not about salvation, it's about service. The servants already belong to the master. They were already owned by the master. And the parable is all about how we serve the master, not how we come to become part of the master's group. And then thirdly, the phrase, he will cut him into pieces, just means he can separate them. And the expression unbelievers means those who were unfaithful. In other words, when Jesus returns, there will be a sorting out of the faithful and the unfaithful. He will reward the faithful, and the unfaithful will lose their rewards. It's like what the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 3 verse 10. When the Lord comes, those who have been faithful will get their reward, and those who haven't will miss out. And when Jesus returns, there'll be a day of reckoning. Let's make sure we get the reward for being faithful. Just as we finish, Daniel Webster was asked on one occasion, what is the greatest thought that can occupy a man's mind? He replied, his accountability to God. His accountability to God. And in New Testament times, this parable was literally lived out on a regular basis. Masters would go away, the servants would be in charge of the household, and it could be weeks or months or years, and when the master returned, as in this parable, he would then reward those who had been faithful and punish those who hadn't. When the master returns, will he find us watching, waiting, working? Or will he be disappointed? Our future service for God is dependent on our earthly service now. It's about service and obedience. How do we use our time? How do we use our money? How do we use our natural talents? How do we use our spiritual gifts? How do we use the gospel message entrusted to us? How do we contribute to the local fellowship? The question is, are we watching, waiting, and working? May the answer for each one of us be, yeah, yes. Be alert, be waiting, be working. Let's pray.